Thank you for joining me for the second half of today's CEU seminar regarding I Don't Know Who I Am, Dealing with Toxic Relationships. Now, we talked about some of the attributes of toxic relationships in the first part, the type of instability that it causes, the lack of identity, the sense of just becoming like whatever the person's around. Like if they're around one type of person acting happy, another type of person sad, always having that sense that they can't share directly their thoughts, their feelings, their opinions on things. So as we enter into this next part of the seminar, I want to talk about some of the literature and the research that I've cited here by Rosenberg. He talks about how oftentimes when we're in a toxic relationship, the person who we're identifying as more the codependent tends to be on an equal and opposite continuum as the emotional manipulator. So oftentimes, if you look at our next PowerPoint slide, you'll see that there's almost like this scale from negative 5 to 0 to plus 5 for both the codependent and the person they're in the relationship with, who will identify as possibly a narcissist slash an emotional manipulator. So at the most extreme point, the codependent becomes completely absorbed with caring for the other person, not able to even receive from them because they're not getting any reciprocal two-way communication or needs met. And that's something that the emotional manipulator plays on. He or she is so self-absorbed that they have nothing that they're able or willing to give in their relationship. So as toxic as that is, there's an equal but opposite relationship going on. Then at the negative 4 and positive 4, we see the codependent is unmotivated and fearful to even get his or her needs met. They're afraid of upsetting the other. The narcissist or emotional manipulator is entitled, still pretty self-absorbed, and gives very little. They're not a genuine giver. You know, when they give, it's usually because there's a certain type of need that they're wanting to get met. At a negative 3 and a positive 3, we see that the codependent still is quite a giving person because that's his or her nature. And they will have a tendency to not really ask for their own needs. The emotional manipulator will try to give sometimes, but again, it just doesn't come naturally. And there's generally going to need to be a lot of validation and recognition and reminders for this to happen. At a negative 2 and a positive 2, the codependent caretaking elements are valued, but they're not really exploited by the emotional manipulator. So there's almost like a mutual agreement for the codependent to be more the giving one in the relationship, where the emotional manipulator prefers to be the one to have his or her needs met. They're not as selfish at this point. And if they're asked to give, they will consider a behavior request. At the negative 1 and positive 1 continuum, we see more of a balance between giving and receiving. There's less exploitation. And at this point, the emotional manipulator is not at the extreme we talked about before. They're both a caretaker and a caregiver. So you see how basically these two different people play off each other in a relationship. And that's what can make the relationship toxic. But sometimes outsiders will look at it and say, gosh, what in the world's going on? Why are these people continuing in a relationship with each other at this point? But actually, it works when you think about it. The codependent prides himself on the idea of being the giver, the helper, the fixer, in theory, because it gives a false sense of control. At least things are predictable. At least they know that the chaos that's going on will continue, and they sort of can have an idea of what's happened in the past, what might happen again, try and guess and skirt around the issues. And it works with the narcissist because he or she is getting their needs met. One of the things that we can work on with the person in the toxic relationship is looking at defense mechanisms. Now, keep in mind that initially, defense mechanisms are outside someone's awareness. Even though they're habitual, even though they're things that have been going on for quite some time, usually clients aren't aware of them. What happens, though, is over time, in their clinical sessions with us, they start to basically act how they would act outside of the session, and we start to see some of this more in session. Keep in mind, even though we might be thinking, well, gosh, that's toxic behavior, these defense mechanisms aren't helpful, in the client's perception, they're useful. Let's take denial, for example. When a client rejects responsibility for their behavior, when they're saying, I don't really have a problem, or I don't know why this happens, this is something that they've done habitually and over time. So going initially in the first several sessions to confronting them isn't going to be a useful pattern. We really want to build up empathy, a sense of connection, positive regard, Rogers process variables, understanding what it is that the client's coming to us with, to where over time we can start to expose some of these defense mechanisms and confront in a way where the client will realize that, oh, wow, I'm doing this, but I didn't even realize it was toxic. Other types of defense mechanisms we might see are things like displacement, the shifting of responsibility to a substitute. Oh, I just couldn't control my behavior because that other person, they made me do this. It was the alcohol. It was the other person. I just couldn't help myself. Another one we might see with clients is undoing, where they're trying to reverse an unhealthy behavior by doing the opposite. I drank all weekend, but when I came to my senses, I realized this really isn't me, so I threw all the liquor in the house down the drain. Or, yeah, I know I mouth off and sometimes get out of control, but I'm really gentle and kind and apologetic. So you might be thinking of some clients that you've dealt with as we talk about these. And like I said, again, these are the norm. They're habitual patterns. So the client oftentimes will not see them as toxic. Another area we might see with the client is what's called intellectualization, the avoiding of unpleasant feelings, which are perceived as negative. So things like, well, I only drink on occasion. It's not like I get drunk all the time. Well, I just have different ways of doing things. Maybe it's not the way that my boss or the company wants, but oh well, it still gets it done. Or they could use something like projection, attributing unacceptable behaviors to others. If that other person wouldn't have done A, B, and C, we also see things like rationalization, justifying our behaviors, or exaggerating claims of moral actions and attitudes. I would never do anything like that. I organized all these community things. I've done outreach. I couldn't have done something that awful. We can see regressive behavior in our clients or repressing certain feelings. So the point is, again, we have tended way back when to be taught the defense mechanisms are something awful and to be avoided. But really, what would it be like if we could look at those as cues to why the client has developed the behavior patterns he or she has developed? That might help us in our counseling sessions. We see that codependents sometimes are more passive in the way they approach codependency. They're more fearful and they just don't rock the boat. But sometimes they're more active, that they try to manipulate and control things. So Bahari, in a 2013 article, talked about some of the questions that codependents tend to ask. So remember, the codependent person tends to be fearful, tends to be cautious, doesn't want to rock the boat. They're wondering what's going to happen next. And oftentimes they'll come to you wondering and just feeling like they don't even know how they got to the point that they're at today. One of the questions they ask is, how can I allow myself to be so fooled? There may be a sense of confusion. Basically, how did I get to this point? So looking at things from the outside, we as a therapist might be able to see, like, gosh, you've done this in 5 other relationships. This isn't an uncommon pattern. But to them, they're not seeing the pattern. They're coming in confused. Another question we might see is, why am I so drawn to these difficult people? So a sense of emotional reactivity. Why am I being punished? They might feel like they've done all the good, right, strong, and perfect things, and they just don't understand why it is that they're getting the short end of things. They might also ask, how do these trying people just always seem to find me? They really don't see the patterns that we see. They might be actually in shock. Do I have doormat written on my forehead? They just don't know how they got to the place that they got to now. And we see the poor boundaries. They're not sure why they can't speak up. So there's some qualities we see in terms of emotional manipulators. And we can teach our clients how to watch out for these qualities. What happens is they tend to, again, polarize things as all good or all bad. So I've seen, for example, a number of codependent women that have looked at relationships that most of us would see as toxic and said, wow, he's so kind, he's so loving, oh, he's so charismatic, look what he does, people just don't understand him, he just had a rough life. So they tend to magnify the positive and minimize some of these signs and signals that the rest of us see. So what are some of these things that we can actually teach our clients to watch out for with the emotional manipulators? One, many of them have an annoying lack of empathy. Even when it seems that the person's pouring out to them what they need, maybe there's a lot of expression of emotion, maybe they've gone round and round the same issue over and over, it seems oftentimes as if the emotional manipulator just doesn't understand what feeling that they're going through, can't put it into words, and struggles to even identify, oh, so you're feeling such and such. Oh, this is what you need. This is what you want. So there's an annoying lack of empathy. They're unable to hear, validate, or understand another person's needs and wants. That fits right in with what we said about the codependency and the emotional manipulators. The emotional manipulators require constant attention and affirmation. They might even brag about their accomplishments. Remember with narcissism and the diagnosis of that axis 2, cluster B type of thing, that we see that the admiration and the affection and attention that they're requiring is out of proportion to the accomplishments that they've achieved, usually. They feel higher and of more worth than others. We might also help our clients to realize that they're in a relationship with someone who's constantly comparing, constantly wanting to elevate him or herself. Oftentimes, we also see the toxic person monopolize conversations, not letting other people talk, being basically an expert on everything, even though the facts don't necessarily show this. There's a lack of humility. Even when there is a flaw or shortcoming, as any of us have, instead of being humble and having a genuine apology, asking what might need to be done for amends or to change things in the future that are hurtful, we usually don't see that very often at all with the emotional manipulators. There's a sense that their experiences and their perceptions are really all that matters. They might be aloof, and then on the other time, they might be grandiose. They too, in a different sense than the codependents, have an unstable identity. You see that emotional and affective instability. They work hard to avoid the emptiness that they feel inside. Emotional manipulators may also exhibit patterns of reckless impulsivity. They might disregard societal norms, and they feel like they're special. The consequences basically don't pertain to them. One of the things that we can work with clients on is developing what I call self-pledges. So I've heard a lot of times in sessions with people who I'd characterize as more codependent what they would like or expect in a healthy relationship. But oftentimes they're not communicating that very directly to the people that they're in relationship with. So helping them come up with a sheet of self-pledges, maybe something they can pin on a wall in the morning when they get up they could look at. They could put in their car, in their purse or wallet. Something that they could give you as a therapist, as well as some healthy friends, that can hold them accountable. So things like, what I think or feel is just as valuable as anyone else. I pledge to myself, as of this date, that I will begin at least 3 times a week to share my opinion with others when they offer their opinion. My time is just as valuable as other people's time. When my friend, who always expects me to take her everywhere, calls, I will pause. I'll consider my schedule. I'll give her a few options rather than just jumping in and saying yes every time. One of the other things we can work with our codependent clients on that are in these toxic relationships is how to be accountable. That's not something that is easy for them. As we talked about, saying no is a difficult thing. We can use some cognitive behavioral approaches to help them separate the part truth or the grain of truth from the lie. Oftentimes they're telling themselves things like, it's my job to make others happy. And of course, not too many people like to personally harm or hurt someone willfully. But to take on all that responsibility of, I need to make everyone around me happy. Whether I try my best and it still doesn't work out, it's still my responsibility. So an alternative truth, for example, would be, I enjoy helping others and get great joy from this, but they put things in balance where they're able to look at other people need to also take some responsibility for their own lives as well. Let's try another example here in terms of separating the grain of truth from the lie. A codependent person might think everyone else is more important than me. But the truth is, others may have realistic needs and concerns. The lie is that it's the codependent's job to attend to all these concerns and putting their needs and wants aside. The truth that they can learn to tell themselves, I can choose what I want to attend to, including my own needs and concerns. I have options. I remember one of the things that one of my clients said was most useful to her was helping her change the language from, I have to do this, I have to clean up after my whole family, I have to do everything for everyone else, to the language of, I choose to. That language helped her realize that, not that automatically the relatives are going to jump in and do their part, but I don't have to just respond this way. I have options. And that's what's freeing for most people in toxic relationships. Because they're not often given the idea from the people they're in relationship with that they have any options. In terms of the separating the lie from the grain of truth, another type of cognitive behavioral approach I've used with people is what I call watch where you put your butts. That saying tends to be funny for clients. A lot of times, we end up saying statements in reverse of what's helpful. We say things like, yeah, I know that there's people that could be there to help me too out there, but it always ends up landing on me. And you see, in that case, what the person's saying after the word but just keeps that sense of helplessness going. Whereas a healthier way that we can teach our clients to approach life is helping them admit their feelings, their concerns in the here and now, but ending up with a rational, realistic perspective. So let's go over some examples on this. Things like, I feel disappointed when I'm not able to intervene to help more people, but I am only one person. It's not wrong to have my plans too. Another one, some of my friends and family may never understand my perspective. They might still say I'm selfish and uncaring because I'm setting boundaries, but it's not my job to convince them to see that what I'm doing is healthy. I feel angry when I think of some of the wrong things my family of origin taught me, but I realize that I can choose what works for me and what is healthy. So what I do with clients is over time, the healthy, more rational, realistic statements that are after that word but, I put those on a separate sheet of paper. And those are the type of comments that we end up using for those positive pledges and affirmations that we talked about earlier. Things like, it's not wrong to have my plans. It's not wrong to set boundaries. It's not my job to convince others. I can choose what works for me and is healthy. Then I'll mention to the client, I'll say, how do you feel when you hear that? When you listen to that, how's that different from what you were telling yourself before? And they say, wow, that's a lot more freeing, a lot more relaxing. Feels less trapped. There's a lot of cognitive behavioral types of things like that we can do. We can teach our clients the red flags that they need to watch out for. Things like shoulds, absolute thoughts, statements of if only then, that make things so linear that are not really that linear in life. Here's another one that we see people in toxic relationships use a lot. The one of enough. If only I had done enough. Or if only that other person did enough. Enough is toxic because it gives us this idea that there's some imaginary line that once we reach, it's enough. I usually ask my client, enough according to whom? What a tiresome task of trying to figure that out. Another red flag, as I stated a little bit ago, was the have-tos and the absolute standards. So what we're essentially trying little by little over time to teach our clients is how to be in the present, how to be in the here and now. Because the problem is sometimes they tend to overemphasize the past, which that leads to the victim mentality. And then if they overemphasize the future, they're not in the present enough. So starting right where we're at, right where they're at in the session, and then going from there. The problem of what clients tend to do is they tend to keep going from one, what I would call fire, to another. Melanie Beatty, who writes a series of books on codependency and overcoming codependency, talks about what she says are the principles of the fire. The fire's not over when the fire truck leaves. Think about that. If a house or a building's burning, the fire truck gets the crisis managed. But now the family whose house was burning down has to deal with, where are we going to live? What are we going to do from here? What about all our precious memories that are gone? How do I redefine myself? Where do I start up again? Another principle she highlights is, a fire can smolder for a long time before it bursts into flames. And when we're talking about codependency and not knowing who I am, being in relationship with toxic others, it's amazing how long people can continue in toxic relationships. A third principle of the fire she highlights is that surviving the fire does not mean there may not be issues and trauma, even for years or quite some time to come. So the things that we can do that are most helpful are accepting, affirming, supporting, loving, and empowering. Oftentimes, that person who feels helpless that's coming to us in that toxic relationship is so focused on what he or she cannot control that they feel trapped. That's why I like to use the Serenity Prayer exercise. If you heard the Serenity Prayer, it talks about knowing the difference between what I can and what I can't control. I will try to help a client to focus on what he or she can control. Oftentimes they'll come to us telling us a multitude of things they feel they cannot control. But what would it be like if there was only one thing or two things they could focus on? Not that they have to focus on everybody else around them, not that they have to take on a bunch of goals at once, but just small, measurable, realistic goals. And then we would help hold them accountable and look at the behaviors that they could do towards those goals. So notice I use the word behaviors. We're helping the person coming to us in counseling to focus on behaviors. Behaviors can be retaught. They can be changed. But feelings can give wrong signals. Feelings, even though they're powerful, are often rooted in past memories, which can be inaccurate. So we're helping people in these toxic relationships learn to trust the process, to forego control, to detach in a healthy way from emotional manipulators and toxicity, to learn that they matter, to learn to love themselves, to allow change to happen. Every possible situation and scenario doesn't need to be guessed at or figured out ahead of time. We're helping our clients learn to accept what is unchangeable or out of our hands. We're helping them live in the present moment. We're helping them to get rid of false guilt and shame. Over time, eventually we might see glimmers of that genuine self-esteem coming forth, that they are as precious as others, that they don't have to try to keep giving out of an empty or a minimal well. Another exercise I like to do with clients that helps them when they feel helpless is an exercise called the Law of Thirds. We can put people in our lives in three different categories. There's one third of people who, no matter what you do, aren't going to like you. You could try and jump through every hoop, do everything right, try and figure out what will make them your friend, and they're just not going to like you no matter what. Trying to care, love, and fix those people ends up only in frustration. So it might be better to not put our energies into that first third. Then we have the second third that's neutral. They may not be our best friend, but they're not really our worst enemy. They're there. They're not an emotional manipulator. They're not a toxic person. But they're someone possibly we can have a relationship with. And then the last third is the people that will like, love, and accept you almost no matter what. Oftentimes, this can be family or relatives or best friends. What happens is, it's almost like the first third gets focused on instead of the last third with the codependent. They're trying to make people who may not ever like them, and be there with them. I'm going to share some affirmations of freedom that could be helpful in working with a client. And these are little exercises, these are little affirmations that can help the codependent to keep going. Because again, we're just talking about small little bits and pieces, small behaviors, not redoing everything all at once. Instead of having expectations of others, codependents can meet expectations for themselves. They didn't cause other people's behavior. They're not responsible for their behavior. They can just focus on their own behavior. They can use a feelings journal to really practice and look at and test out the accuracy of their feelings against alternative behaviors that might be more healthy. Practicing meditation or spirituality can help. Sometimes just choosing to pursue their own interest and have fun, whether other people understand it or not, can be helpful. I remember one of the seminars that was an audio seminar that I listened to years ago. They gave an example of a lady who kept driving past this ice cream shop and badly wanted to go in and just relax and have some ice cream. And as silly as it sounds, the therapist basically asked her, well, why not? If that's important to you, why aren't you doing it? And there were all sorts of negative cognitions of, if I do this, who's going to see me? Oh, what if they see I'm alone there at the ice cream shop? Oh, what if this? What if that? And all these negative cognitions going around. But one of the most helpful things we can do to increase that overall level of freedom in our clients is to hold them accountable to pursue things that they're interested in, that are leisure things that provide fun for them. We can remind them that they really can't predict, change, and fix others. We can help them to create that healthy pause and time out, to learn to step away and take time to think things over, whether it's in the middle of a conflict or disagreement, or whether their heart and their intuition just tells them, things are off. They can focus on increasing their positive self-time. Sometimes just writing down things they're thankful for or things they like about themselves can be helpful. That's not usually automatic. That takes time. But you know, when I've counseled someone over several months and they've done that, it's been wonderful to see after 6 to 9 months what type of things they come up with and they notice about themselves that they really hadn't paid attention to before. And one of the final things we can do with them is help them to take these negative labels off themselves. Instead of making assumptions and just looking at these adjectives of, oh, I'm this, oh, I'm that. These adjectives that are not life-giving. They can make changes. They can change from old messages to new life-giving messages. So we're helping them make a change from essentially believing, I'm not okay as I am. I am so afraid I can't even share my thoughts or feelings. I should be at a better place than I am. I'm not allowed to be happy or productive in life. I can't trust myself. change is awful. I'll just always be let down, and I don't get to share my opinion. Those are the old messages they're oftentimes coming in with. But let's look at some possible new messages. And honestly, when you work overtime with these clients, it is possible through the clinical counseling relationship and through the work we do with them for them to actually start in small doses to believe these new messages. Things like, I am accepted, worthwhile, and valued as I am. My thoughts, feelings, and beliefs and actions are acceptable. I can take things one step at a time, even in spite of the anxiety and the unknown. I don't have to change and figure and fix everything out there. I can live in the here and now without being over-idealized or regretful of what didn't happen or overly negative. My responsibility is actually just to seek after goals which are productive and life-giving to me. So you're probably wondering, how do we get a client to that point? Part of it is step by step. Helping a client develop a healthy daily routine. Having a routine and seeing those healthy behaviors happen over and over time is what will make them habitual and replace the old negative habits. It will help reinforce in that client's mind that they can allow themselves to choose. They can focus on self-care. They can have freedom from blame, guilt, and resentment. They're not just a victim anymore. They can choose between caring for and caring about. Remember, we made a distinction that it's not their job to care for someone else, but they can care about someone with boundaries. The new or improved person can have more optimism and decide logically what's best for him or her. Living in freedom, what does that look like to them? Acceptance. That's a really different place than when they first come in. Surrender, allowing things to happen in the here and now, taking responsibility for their part, and letting go. Part of this may be making amends. One of the things we have to be careful about is helping our clients focus on just making amends for their part, and again, not taking on the part of the toxic people around them. So I'm going to read a quote here from one of Melody Beattie's books about the Guide to the 12 Steps, where she talks about what genuinely making amends looks like. Once we make amends, the other person is not responsible for clearing away our residue of fear, guilt, or shame. It's our job to let go of the incident, not theirs. On the other hand, we are not responsible for the feelings the other person may have about the incident. Our part is only to make a direct amend, then do whatever work we need to do ourselves to be done with our shame and guilt. After we've made an amend, if the other person's unwilling to let the incident go, or if the other person wants to stew in the problem, that's their issue. All of our recovery, all of what we're going through, has to do with making amends to ourselves. Think about that for a minute. That's a powerful statement. Let me repeat that. All of our recovery, all of what we're going through, has to do with making an amend to ourselves. Giving ourselves permission to have our feelings is making an amend. Giving ourselves permission to be happy and alive is an amend. Taking gentle, compassionate, loving care of ourselves is an amend. Learning to set boundaries, be direct, and stop defeating and victimizing ourselves is an amend. Learning to stop allowing others to mistreat and control us is an amend. Learning to listen and trust ourselves is an important amend. Learning to trust our instincts and value our feelings and needs is an amend. We have many amends to make to the frightened, abused, and neglected child within us. Amends for being so critical, negligent, and shameful. One of the comments that I'll often say to my clients is, don't pick up where the other toxic person left off. Because what happens, sometimes our clients will tend to internalize beliefs that have not been healthy. What's an alternative? Focusing on what positive psychology teaches us. Focusing on gratitude. Affirming what's meaningful and helpful, what's well and healthy. Doing exercises like the cognitive behavioral ones we talked about earlier. Being relational. And again, these may need to be intentional for many of our clients. Codependency existed in relationships, so healing will also exist in relationships. The very thing that's vulnerable is what really will bring victory. And if there's anything over time and through the remainder of this seminar that we really want to highlight, is that vulnerability is not an awful, dirty word. Sometimes vulnerability and learning to figure out the self and the identity of who the client really is what it's all about. That's where the victory is. Learning to look at our relationships and see the balance of the good and the bad. Having the boundary setting. Accepting people, but confronting problems. So in this next PowerPoint, I talk about get a life. One of the things that we may need to work with a client on is defining the word living. What does living mean operationally? I would say that many of our clients really have not, quote, had a life. They've oftentimes been stuck in reaction mode. So it's hard for them to consider their own goals and expectations. Some of them have difficulty even saying what they want. They may come to us saying what they don't want, the things they don't want to see happening anymore, but to say proactively what they'd like to see happening is challenging. So helping them get comfortable with the idea of process. Moving beyond codependency is working at moving beyond shame. Shame says, I'm a bad person. I'm awful. I can't do anything right. If I would have done things right, then I wouldn't have had all these problems in relationships. Shame says the person is bad. Guilt says, you know what? I should have changed a behavior. Maybe there's things I could do differently. And from here, I'm going to pick up and make different choices. So that's what we're helping clients do, is change behaviors and move beyond shame. Move beyond personalizing things that alienate, reject, and deprive them. Help them trust the warning signs and the intuitive things that they have within them. Helping them implement positive choices. Helping them learn they can have choices, they can take a deep breath, that they have alternatives. Another thing that's very helpful that we can work with codependents on is helping differentiate between healthy and unhealthy anger. Many times, I've seen clients that have falsely assumed that any and all anger is bad. They don't understand that sometimes anger can be a healthy signal to a missed expectation that needs to be grieved, an injustice or something that just wasn't fair in life, or an improper perspective that might need to be fixed. the worst thing that they can do, which oftentimes is a natural thing that they do, is to suppress that anger or for it to just come out in explosive ways when they're finally just at a point of having enough. So helping our clients choose wisely. What needs to be vented? What needs to be shared? Where does an I message need to be sent? Something like, I feel such and such. This is what I need. This is the behavior I'm requesting from here. So we're helping clients differentiate between passive, aggressive, and assertive responses. So realizing that assertiveness is not a bad thing. So an example of an aggressive response might be, your meetings are always more important than me. You never care about me or make me a priority. You see how that's reactive? That's out of control. There's no pause in there. It's not sharing how the dynamics and the relationship are affecting or what alternative behavior they would like. So aggressive responses are toxic. Passive responses are also toxic. Someone says, okay, have a good day then. Really doesn't solve the problem. It really doesn't explore the emotions or the desired behaviors. But the healthy response is the assertive response. I'm sure I'll cope, but in the future, I'd like for you to arrange to give me at least 1 week advance notice if possible when you have these surprise meetings. You see the difference between these? Let's try another one here. So, if someone says to us, your mother just interferes with everything and messes it up. She better not be here when I get back. It would be easy to want to mouth off to that, wouldn't it? An aggressive response would be, well, at least my mom talks to me more than you ever do. That's not going to help because that's going to get into a back and forth conflict. The passive response of, well, you know how she is, won't be helpful either. But an assertive response could actually help the situation, even if the other person is rather toxic. Let's take an example here. I'm going to repeat again the toxic statement and then see how the assertive response can actually change the dynamic. Your mother just interferes with everything and messes it up. She better not be here when I get back. Now, the assertive response is, I know it's annoying to you when she's here, especially when we lose track of time. Perhaps you could give me some signals to let me know when you're about to come home so I can wind things up. You see how that's respectful? That changes the whole tone of the conversation. Let's try one more here. You don't do anything around the house. Would be easy to react aggressively to say something like, if you can't appreciate what I do, then leave. Someone else will appreciate me. But an alternative would be a healthy, assertive response. It may be frustrating seeing things that are more messy here than we'd like. I've had such a busy day. If you don't mind, we can talk later and decide how we can get things accomplished. So you see, we always have a choice, and we can teach clients to be direct and assertive in a healthy way. One of the first principles I'll teach a client is how to say no more and no less than really what they need to say. What's most important? Really getting to the point. That's why I like to use the I message, because there's those three sections built in. What the person feels, what they're concerned about, and what they would like to happen in the future. With directness, there's not that assumption of what people know or don't know. We're telling them directly, and if they don't understand, they can ask us a question and we can clarify. Directness is also a positive skill because it helps our yes to mean yes and our no to mean no. People will learn to start taking us seriously when we're consistent and when our behaviors line up with what we're saying that we feel or believe. Directness also speaks just from one's own perspective instead of analyzing and evaluating other people. It talks in terms of concrete behaviors and resists the urge to defend. Melody Beatty, in one of her books, talks about this concept of healthy assertiveness. She says, quote, "I am responsible for myself. I am responsible for leading or not living my life. I am responsible for tending to my spiritual, emotional, physical, and financial well-being. I am responsible for identifying and meeting my needs. I am responsible for solving my problems and learning to live with those I cannot solve. I am responsible for my choices. I am responsible for what I give and what I receive. I am also responsible for setting and achieving my goals. I am responsible for how much I enjoy life or for how much I don't. I am responsible for whom I love and how I choose to express this love. I am responsible for what I do to others or what I allow others to do to me. I am responsible for my own wants and desires. All of me, every aspect of my being is important. I count for something. I matter, and my feelings can be trusted." As I said before, healthy communication focuses on I messages. I feel such and such because, and then describing just the behaviors that are happening, and then the future I'd like, and describing what we'd like more of. The interesting thing is, you may notice that I'm spending a lot of time on the importance of healthy communication, because those who express their feelings in healthy ways are actually shown in the literature to be more likable, more intelligent, more personable and friendly, have better social development. So there's a lot of positives about that. Some of the things we can teach our clients are how to beware of negative or unhelpful anger reactions. Remember I said when we were teaching assertiveness, we're differentiating it between assertive, aggressive, and passive. And one of the things we also may want to do is, as you know, I provide a lot of handouts, is provide a handout on what I call the 8 aversive strategies of anger reactions. Usually as I teach these things, clients will say, oh, that's me. This is what I do. Or this is what that person that I'm in an unhealthy relationship with does. And we'll talk about the side effects of these negative or aversive strategies and how it really hurts the relationship. 1, discounting, which means shaming people into agreeing with you. Another one is withdrawal or abandonment, giving essentially an emotional deep freeze when you don't get what you want. Threats, a partner actively hurting the other in an attempt to control him or her. Blaming, belittling or denigrating the person. That's like using those personal adjectives to describe the person instead of just stating the behavior that you'd like to be different. Things like guilt tripping, blaming someone, derailing a conversation, or withdrawing pleasure, love, affection from them. What happens when someone's in a toxic relationship and using these aversive strategies is that it becomes like a nightmare. It really does become fearful when you're on the receiving end. Rosenberg, who we talked about earlier, said in his book, the soulmate of your dreams becomes the cellmate of your nightmares. That's why it's very important to look at using these I messages, talking from our point of view, using assertive techniques. We can use what's called in the literature nonviolent communications. We can observe, state our feeling reaction to it, what our needs are, and then to make behavior requests. So an observation would involve things like, I noticed that, and then you'd fill in the blank with specific concrete behaviors, things that are measurable, achievable, or concrete actions. Then the next statement would be, when this happens, I feel. The I message is so important because the person speaking is taking responsibility for their reaction. They're just sharing their emotion state and what they're going through. And then ultimately making behavior requests. Communication and feelings can be difficult sometimes to share. Timing of communication is another thing that's real helpful to talk to our clients about. I've had so many couples or families or just systems that I've worked with that ended up making assumptions or misjudgments about each other because really their timing was off. So there's some rules that can help develop healthy communication. Timing of communication. One, learn to take a break when communication goes beyond a certain amount of time without empathy and progression towards understanding and support. Two, during the break, each person should write I messages describing how he or she feels, or his or her perception of the incident and expectations for the future. Three, in the meantime, while waiting for the next time frame, spend time relaxing and doing something that's incongruent with building resentment. Four, learn to start up your conversation in a soft way or pause until you're able to use the I messages in a calm tone of voice. Five, which can be challenging, accept your partner's responses as well. And let me clarify, accept doesn't necessarily mean agree. There are many a times in my counseling sessions where we end the session with both people having a very different perception about what happened on something. But there's a way still, in spite of that, to be respectful. For both people to be able to share their perceptions and what they need from there. Number six, with timing of communication, make a behavior request for what you need. Phrase them as questions and options. Remember that word options can be very freeing. We have choices. Be willing to negotiate for in-between steps if we need to add something in there. So if you're giving a behavior request, I always suggest that people start with, would you be willing to, and then fill in the blank. Express appreciation to your spouse or partner for attending, for spending that time paying attention. One of the things we do have to hit on here is during conflict management, if there needs to be a timeout, for communication, there shouldn't be final words. All too often I've had couples where one's walking away and says something under their breath, or they do something that really doesn't make it a true timeout and a healthy situation to transition back later. So in terms of rules for timeouts, I say no final words, leave immediately. Set the time to come back together. So say something like, this discussion doesn't seem to be going very well. I think it might be good for us to take a little break for a half hour, evaluate each of our actions, and write some of the iMessages, think about and write about what we're feeling and what we need, and then come back in about a half hour. Don't rehearse what to say next. Don't think about how you're going to get back with the other person, but do something, again, incongruent with resentment. And don't use drugs or alcohol. Don't use anything that's going to make you more impulsive in your reaction. It's important to plan ahead for problem times. We all have them, and we can plan ahead if we think of how we can self-evaluate. One of the biggest keys I've had with couples, and when there's toxic dynamics going on, is making sure that they have decided ahead of time where each is going to, using their handouts, using their things to self-evaluate, and to look at how they can change only their behavior. Again, the goal during the timeout isn't looking at pointing fingers. It's what can I take responsibility for? What can I make amends for? What do I want to make an assertive comment about? What do I have a request about for in the future? When we're talking about needs and behavior requests, sometimes the simplest comment is the best. I'm needing such and such. State what you need physically. If it's, I'm needing you to stop what you're doing and us to just focus on the task at hand. I'm needing you to sit next to me and put your arms around me when things are upsetting to me. I'm needing validation for the type of things that I'm thinking and going through, that even though we disagree, that what I'm thinking and feeling is just as important. I'm needing a break for us to do something fun instead of always fighting. You see, codependents end up paying a big price for these toxic relationships. A lot of times they end up missing things like love, trust, nurturance, reassurance, security, respect, friendship, peace, happiness, and pleasure. So those are things that may be helpful to help a codependent put into words, what would those look like? In terms of relationship therapy, I will also use handouts on prioritizing the relationship. Not that we're voting which way of prioritizing things is right or wrong, but to just help create a dialogue in the relationship about what needs and behaviors are most important to each one. We do this in the context of talking about the love languages, of talking about how each person defines love and what means love in a different way. So I'll give the couple a handout about prioritizing your relationship. We'll look at 7 categories of needs. Things like security, which means a sense of permanence in the relationship. Companionship. Sexual intimacy. Understanding and tenderness. Encouragement. Intellectual closeness. And mutual activities. And as we look through each of those, I'll have them separately prioritize what they would like to happen and what they think is currently happening. We'll also talk about behavioral actions that would embody each of these. So for someone, understanding and tenderness might be, sit close to me when we're having a discussion. Show that you're proud to be my partner. Don't do something else at the same time as we're having this discussion. Someone else's understanding and tenderness may be something else. Again, even if a couple has a totally opposite order of those 7 things and those priorities, what I clarify is there's no right and wrong. Sometimes, for one person, understanding and tenderness might be a way to get to physical intimacy or together activity time. For another person, they might have the opposite. They're just different ways of getting to the same important goals. And the thing is helping our couples to actually dialogue about this. What we're trying to do is help cultivate a sense of emotional freedom in the relationship, where each person takes healthy ownership of his or her part. There's four parts that ultimately we're wanting them to take ownership of and move toward to create a healthy relationship. One, what was done. And again, we're not going to pick apart whose narrative is right or wrong, but just hearing and empathizing, doing some perspective taking on each other's sense about what happened. Second, an ownership statement of responsibility. Everyone has some sense of responsibility. And it's really important if you can teach each person in a relationship to take responsibility for just his or her part. I've had clients come to me and say, well, what if I take responsibility and the person who I think really did the action or the toxic or unhealthy action never takes responsibility? And my response is, when we're talking about a system or a relationship dynamic, even if one person, whether it's the person who caused things or didn't, even if one person takes responsibility for his or her part, even if one person learns how to do healthy behavior change, it will cause there to be a reevaluation of the dynamics of the relationship. And then we're also teaching specific apologies. So empathizing with how our behavior affected the other, how that person experienced it. And again, empathy doesn't mean agreement, just trying to understand. And then finally, one of the most important steps is commitment to something new. I think it's really important to not just leave open-ended after clients say an apology. Okay, we're sorry. Now let's move on. I think there needs to be a specific commitment and a statement of what are we going to do different. So the good apology that's specific, that's empathic, and that talks about an alternative type of action would be what we're looking at. An example of this would be something like, I feel confused when you start sharing a story about your workday and then you change topics. I'd like to understand what happened at work today. Would you be willing to repeat yourself? Could we talk about the next topic after we finish talking about this? So you see how all of these things work together. Empathy, listening, specific behavior requests. I'm going to read a poem that was in one of Rosenberg's books that he actually wrote that has to do about behavior change. If I clearly understand, you intend no demand. I'll usually respond when you call. But if you come across like a high and mighty boss, you'll feel like you ran into a wall. And when you remind me so piously about all those things you've done for me, you better get ready. Here comes another bout. Then you can shout. You can spit, moan, groan, and throw a fit. I still won't take the garbage out. Now, even if you should change your style, it's going to take a little while before I can forgive and forget, because it seems to me that you didn't see me as human too until all your standards were met. You see why the perspective taking is so important? One of the neatest exercises I have people do is making a behavior request list. Looking at what are some of the things that have worked before or that you think would work for the health of the relationship. Are there types of actions that really seem particularly considerate, that really warmed your heart? Is it possible to do more of those? Are there ways either of you have communicated so far that really made an impact? Are there financial decisions, child care, or leisure activities that have really impacted you in a positive way? Are there tasks around the house that when they were done as a team made a difference? Is there a way physical affection was done? Is there a way of sharing opinions? And when you make these lists, you can trade them with your partner, your spouse, your friend, and look at them as a cheat sheet of, here's things that have made a difference, have made a positive impact. I'm wondering if any of these are things you'd be willing to do again. And that way, they can pick a few, one or two at a time, and start to do that. We talked a little bit earlier, and I alluded to the fact of how important the word vulnerable is. How many people think of it as a negative word, but actually, it can be very positive. Vulnerability has to do with risk. I'm going to read a few things about risk from an article that I cited by Olson, Fallon, and Morrow. To laugh is to risk appearing a fool. To weep is to risk appearing sentimental. To reach out for another is to risk involvement. To expose feelings is to risk rejection. To place your dreams before the crowd is to risk ridicule. To love is to risk not being loved in return. To go forward in the face of overwhelming odds is to risk failure. But risks must be taken because the greatest hazard in life is to risk nothing. The person who risks nothing does nothing, has nothing, is nothing. He may avoid suffering and sorrow, but he cannot learn, feel, change, grow, or love. Chained by his servitude, he's a slave. He has forfeited his freedom. Only a person who takes risks is free. So we're going to stop here today to think about that, and then we will continue our last section with some more techniques on communication concerns and some ways of verbalizing boundaries in relationships.